books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and this week's show is recorded live on location at the Wigtown Book Festival. Three very different authors in today's show, recorded on location at Scotland's Booktown, the Wigtown Book Festival. Later in the show, Elizabeth Oldfield will be tending to the soul in turbulent times in her book Fully Alive. Author of Trainspotting, Irvin Welsh, will tell us about Resolution, the new Ray Lennox crime mystery. Also on today's show, we'll find some new books in the RNIB Talking Books Library, including the new Sally Rooney. But first up, Ariane Banks talks about The Quality of Love. Ariane Banks has had a long career in publishing, and her writings appeared in places such as The Spectator, TLS, Financial Times, and Country Life. She was at the Wigtown Book Festival to talk about her book, The Quality of Love, Twin Sisters at the Heart of the Century, a biography of her mother and her aunt. As a small child in the 1950s, Ariane Banks was pushed on her swing by A.J. Ayer, beaten at Chinese checkers by Kosler, and entertained by Laurie Lee playing the fiddle and spinning plates. Her first toy was a bear sent by Albert Camus. All very ordinary to a child, living a quiet country life, unaware of the turbulent history echoing around her. Now, using a box of correspondence she found, the adult Ariane looks back to reconstruct an engaging and untold story. The audio version of The Quality of Love, Twin Sisters at the Heart of the Century, is read by Darren Edwards.
What elusive quality is it that propels people into the centre of things? My mother, Celia Paget, and her identical twin sister, Mamane, seemed to possess that quality, to gravitate towards the very heart of the era in which they lived. Born in 1916 and brought up in relative simplicity in rural Suffolk, their lives became entangled with some of the most remarkable figures of the 20th century, whether as friends or lovers, muses or wives.
This book is a book about my mother and her identical twin sister, Celia and Mamane Paget, who moved in very interesting circles in the middle of the last century, the 20th century, because they were very close to all the leading writers, intellectuals, philosophers and thinkers of the time. And they led pretty exciting lives.
After my mother's death in 2002, I started to go through the contents of the old tin trunk she had left me. Yes, the proverbial trunk in the attic. So quaint, so nostalgic. Today, its contents would all be scattered in the cloud. But there it was, capacious and sooty black, with the fading initials EMP, for Eric Morton Paget, on the lid, indicating that it had once belonged to my grandfather. Opening it was to summon back my mother's spirit and that of the aunt I never knew, for the heaps of tattered brown envelopes and superannuated files conjured the sisters' animated dialogue with every pen stroke of their contents.
They lost their mum very early, and then after being home educated for a while, they lost their father as well at a very young age.
Yes, and that was a tragedy for them because they had not been to school, they had really no friends, they had very few relatives. And then they were suddenly pitched out of a very happy rural Suffolk childhood into the maelstrom of wealthy London relatives who really thought that the only point in being a girl was to get married and settle down. And they had very different ideas indeed. They wanted to be educated, they wanted to go to decent schools, they would have loved to have gone to university. And as soon as they could, when they were 21, they escaped.
You did show a photograph of them looking very beautiful, but as you said, looking very angry as well.
Yes, because they were forced to become debutantes and they thought it was a complete and utter waste of time. They didn't want to get married at that age. They were only 18 at the time. They thought it was far too young. They rightly surmised that they wouldn't meet any man who really interested them on the circuit. And it was just not their scene in any way. So what they wanted was to meet very bright, interesting, cultured, well-read, thinking men, and they did.
They inherited a small estate from their father and then travelled. Where did they go?
Well, they had been to finishing school in Switzerland, where they'd met a lot of European girls. When they were there, they learnt French, Italian, German, and they made friends all over the continent. And really, when they had a little bit of money of their own and also earned through modelling, they shot off to stay with all these friends all over Europe, Czechoslovakia, Ruthenia, Italy, France, Spain. They went as far as their spirits could take them.
Here were the letters that Celia and Mamane had exchanged when apart, which, given Mamane's peripatetic life with Arthur Koestler in Wales, Paris, Palestine and America, were many and frequent, taking on the role of diaries in their eventful and sociable lives. Here, too, were several cardboard folders that stopped me in my tracks. One of letters from Albert Camus, in French, of course, that I had never properly deciphered. Love letters to Mamane, and deeply affectionate letters to Celia, and to his former rival, Arthur, after Mamane's death.
Let's drop some names. Who did they meet?
Well, through Mamane's first lover, Dick Windham, they met and got to know very well Cyril Connolly, who was just about to found Horizon magazine, William Walton, the composer, Constant Lambert, another composer, Matthew Smith, the painter, and Sir Cheverel Sitwell, in fact, all the Sitwells. Jessica Mitford became a friend of theirs. That was their world, and they, during the war, also met George Orwell and Arthur Koestler. And after the war, Mamane became very close to the French writer Albert Camus.
At first, I found his handwriting difficult to read, but I soon picked up its idiom and his turn of phrase. It's strange how quickly that can happen. Only recently, tucked between other papers, did I find a tiny Wallace Heaton envelope, by appointment to H.M. the King, containing the undeveloped negatives of snaps of Camus that Mamane had taken during their week exploring Provence together. Another folder contained letters and documents concerning George Orwell, including a copy of the infamous List of Fellow Travellers that he compiled for my mother in 1949 while lying gravely ill in Cranham Nursing Home. At the bottom of the pile was a battered package addressed to Mamane in wonky capital letters, containing the passionate, ill-spelt and vivid letters, some recounting his intrepid travels throughout the Middle East, that her first lover, the flamboyant arch-bohemian Dick Windham, had sent her over the several years of their affair and beyond, from 1937 until his death in 1948, and envelopes of engaging correspondence with my mother from a host of later friends, Sir Cheverel Sitwell, Laurie Lee, Francis Partridge, Benjamin Britten, and Peter Piers among them.
A clip of Darren Edwards reading from The Quality of Love. Did you have any choice in the narrator?
I did indeed, and I chose Darren. I was very sad not to be able to narrate the book myself. I would love to have done that, but there was a very small window of opportunity, and I was abroad the only time that I could have done it. But I had a choice of several readers, and I chose Darren.
Is there a sequel in the works?
There isn't a sequel at the moment, no. I don't think there'll be a sequel as such, but what I may do in the future is to expand on the lives of some of the more peripheral characters of my book, because they were certainly worth expanding on.
Which is one you'll definitely have to narrate.
I'd love to.
It's a publishing question. 5 years ago, a book like that I don't think would have had an audio version. Have you noticed the explosion in audiobooks?
I certainly have, because 5 years ago I wasn't listening to audiobooks myself. It was actually during lockdown when I was reading voraciously, but also gardening and, you know, pottering around a great deal at home. And my husband very kindly gave me a subscription to audiobooks, and I have never looked back. I love them. I find they add enormously to my reading life.
And you told me off mic that you support RNIB. Is that a cause that's quite close to you?
Very much so. For me, my visual life is so very important, not only reading, but also looking at paintings and the sheer beauty of the landscape. And I've always felt that if I were to lose my sight, it would be, for me, it would be a terrible, grievous loss. And I feel very, very sympathetic with people who have problems with their sight. So I have supported RNIB for, I would say, 30 years, if not more.
And of course, your book is now available in audio, so it's accessible.
I'm thrilled about that. I'm really thrilled.
These relationships and the letters which so vividly convey them spanned the intense middle decades of the 20th century. Decades when the old order was shattered by war and new ideas, beliefs and ways of living were emerging. Orwell, Kessler and Camus were at the epicentre of the great debates of the last century between communism and anti-communism, freedom and totalitarianism. Although we once thought we had moved on and such titanic struggles would no longer occupy us to the same degree, we are again confronted today by their implications.
The Quality of Love, Twin Sisters at the Heart of the Century, is available in audio commercially. And Ariane, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Plus, you can enjoy a book for the younger listener or young at heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. New in the library, we have Deep in a Dream, The Long Night of Chet Baker by James Gavin.
The Christmas season of 1929 arrived just weeks after the stock market had crashed. But that December, 19-year-old Vera Baker got the gift of her dreams. In her little Oklahoma house, she gazed down at the infant in her arms, an angel with alabaster skin and hazel eyes. When he smiled at her, she saw magic. The child would surely lift her above the cold realities of marriage to a frequently unemployed alcoholic. More than that, he would bring meaning to her life, supplying all the tenderness and excitement that were missing. He was named Chesney, after his father. But with his chubby cheeks and dark hair, the child seemed like a tiny replica of herself. From the time of his birth, Chetty, as she called him, was the center of Vera's universe. Her obsession with him, and his father's response to it, had a darker effect on Chet Baker than he ever acknowledged. Even he probably didn't understand it. Years later, he told Lisa Galt Bond, his collaborator on an unfinished memoir, "I had a very happy childhood, no problems."
From his emergence in the 1950s, when an uncannily beautiful young man from Oklahoma appeared in the West Coast and became seemingly overnight the prince of cool jazz, until his violent drug-related death in Amsterdam in 1988, Chet Baker lived a life that has become an American myth. At once sexy and forbidding, the so-called James Dean of jazz struck a note of menace in the staid 50s. In this first major biography, the story of Baker's demise is finally revealed. So is the truth behind his tormented childhood. Behind Baker's icy facade lay something ominous, unspoken. The mystery drove both sexes crazy, but his only real romance, apart from music, was with drugs. Gavin brilliantly recreates the life of a man whose journey from golden promise to eventual destruction mirrored America's fall from post-war innocence, but whose music has never lost the power to enchant and seduce us.
The tendency to keep things hidden had been ingrained in him from an early age. In 1954, he brought his French girlfriend, Liliane Couquier, to his parents' home during the first national tour of the Chet Baker Quartet. She observed the Bakers for 3 weeks.
"This was a family where nobody hollered, didn't say what they had in their hearts or in their minds," she noticed. "Everyone was just trying to be cool."
Couquier recalled Chesney and Vera as
Oklahoma peasants, ordinary white people from way in the center.
Starting in 1946, Chesney drove a yellow cab, the only job he had held on to for more than a couple of years. For a while in the 20s, he had lived his dream by touring as a guitar and banjo player. He worked mainly in hillbilly bands. But according to his son, Chesney had a feeling for jazz. He could whistle the licks of his hero, the Texas-born trombone master Jack Teagarden, while improvising on guitar. Then came the Depression and the birth of his child, and he was forced to quit music and take a series of dreary survival jobs. He rarely mentioned his frustration, but it showed on his face. By his 30s, he looked old and haggard, with crow's feet spreading down his cheeks, pointing to a mouth that rarely smiled. He kept his sandy hair combed back, exposing a deeply furrowed brow. That prematurely ravaged look was inherited by his son, whose facial decay in later years would be commonly blamed on drug abuse. Chesney, though, aged far less strikingly. Bernie Fleischer recalled him as very bland-looking, a man who faded into the background. He was one of those shadowy figures who was always away somewhere. In the 40s, Chesney surfaced occasionally to brag to his son's musician friends about a night when the great Teagarden had come to the house to jam with him. Some of them would later suspect that the fabled meeting had never happened at all.
Deep in a Dream, The Long Night of Chet Baker, by James Gavin, is read by Jeff Harding and runs for 18 hours and 29 minutes.
Penguin Random House has donated the latest book in the best-selling Jackson Brodie series. Death at the Sign of the Rook is by Kate Atkinson.
In fact, it had begun over a week ago, when Jackson acquired a new client. Two new clients, actually, although they came as a pair. Twins, in fact. Ian and Hazel, the pensionable-aged progeny of the recently deceased Dorothy Padgett. Jackson had not warmed to Hazel when she contacted him on the phone, but she wanted to meet in Ilkley, the scene of the crime, as she referred to it, and Ilkley boasted a Betty's Cafe tea rooms that Jackson had never visited. It wasn't the siren call of a toasted tea cake that drew him, so much as the promise of order, of sanctuary even. "A clean, well-lighted place," his ex, Julia, said when he had tried to explain the attraction. "That's Hemingway, and don't pretend you know that, because you don't." He didn't, but he was fairly sure you would never find Hemingway in Betty's, chomping on an iced fancy. Hemingway's loss.
Welcome to Rook Hall. The stage is set, the players are ready. By night's end, a murderer will be revealed. Ex-detective Jackson Brodie is staving off a bad case of midlife malaise when he's called to a sleepy Yorkshire town and the seemingly tedious matter of a stolen painting. But one theft leads to another, including the disappearance of a valuable Turner from Burton Makepeace, home to Lady Milton and her family. Once a magnificent country house, Burton Makepeace has now partially been converted into a hotel hosting murder mystery weekends. As paying guests, a vicar, an ex-army officer, impecunious aristocrats and old friends converge, we're treated to a fiendishly clever mystery, one that pays homage to the masters of the genre, from Agatha Christie to Dorothy Sayers.
"And this is where the painting hung, in your mother's bedroom?" Jackson had asked, contemplating the ghostly outline, as if whatever had been on the wall had been vaporised. He was reminded of Hiroshima. He was in a dark mood, feeling the weight of history on his back. His teenage son, Nathan, clearly wasn't going to take up the burden. "Yes," Hazel Sanderson, née Paget, said. She had been a geography teacher before retiring. When Jackson was at school, geography had consisted of tracing maps and colouring them in and getting a whack on the back of your hand with a wooden ruler if you made a mistake. Perhaps it had advanced since then. Perhaps not. "It was a portrait," Ian said. "Small, about 10 by 10 without the frame, approximately," he added, in case he sounded as though he had measured it. He had, Jackson thought. Ian was retired from insurance and had the dull, faded patina of someone who had spent their life indoors. "You could add on another 2 inches for the frame," he went on. "It was fancy. Gold." "Not real gold," Hazel intervened hastily. "Obviously." "The whole thing's missing," Ian continued. "Not cut from the frame the way that thieves usually do." He'd been on the internet, Jackson thought. "It was very, Ian searched for a word. "Portable," he concluded. "Portable?" Jackson didn't think he'd ever heard that word used for a work of art. Made sense, though, if you were going to steal one.
Death at the Sign of the Rook by Kate Atkinson is read by Jason Isaacs and runs for 9 hours and 32 minutes.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
A first-time visitor to the Wigtown Book Festival was Irvin Welsh. He was there to talk about Resolution, the third and supposedly final Ray Lennox book. It was featured on our new book slot a few weeks back, so here, once again, is Lynn Livingston.
Penguin Random House have donated the latest book in a series by Irving Welsh, which was on television as the show Crime, starring Dougree Scott. The latest title is Resolution. Ray Lennox is determined to move on from his darkest days. The former detective has left Edinburgh for a fresh start in Brighton. Soon his fixations and addictions have been replaced with quiet evenings and a rigorous fitness regime. Then Lennox meets Matthew Cardingworth. Rich, smooth-talking and immaculately dressed, he presents himself as a successful and respectable property developer. Yet their encounter reawakens memories that have haunted Lennox for decades, sending him into a spiral of confusion and rage. Lennox has no choice. He must confront the events of his childhood. But the more he identifies the links between Cardingworth, the disappearance of a group of foster care boys, and the violence in his past, the more he finds himself asking, what will he sacrifice to achieve resolution at last?
If the traffic is kind, Eastbourne is just under a 50-minute drive away from Ray Lennox's flat. Underdressed for winter's bite in bomber jacket, jeans and T-shirt, he shivers. The Scot in him unable to comprehend that the south of England can get cold too. But the Alfa Romeo's heating satisfyingly kicks in, and his body relaxes as he lets his eyes flicker lazily in the weak but welcome December sun. Then he's jolted. An angry toot from a BMW tearing past him. He lowers his sun visor, and in the absence of the chewing gum he likes to keep in supply, sucks on his bottom lip. The seaside resort retains a crusty air of decline. Unlike Bournemouth or Hastings, it's yet to be injected with new life by an influx of the artists priced out of Brighton. But the town's traditional old retirees are his bread and butter.
Tamdeen Byrne reading from Resolution by Irvin Welsh. I asked Irvin Welsh about the book.
It's the third in a trilogy featuring Ray Lennox, a kind of a guy who tries to track down sex offenders because he's been a victim of them in his past, and that's his mission, basically.
What was it about Ray Lennox who was a tiny part of filth that sort of stood out, and you wanted to give him his own book?
He was a guy of secrets, and a guy who's got secrets is always, you know, he seemed to be a character that hit me in that way, so you can always, it gives you a lot of leeway to create that kind of character.
Expensively fitted and swish of decor, the wine bar, its walls bedecked with the efforts of local artists, is noisy and boisterous. Clustered groups cluck contentedly over Greg Lake's hopeful declaration, "I believe in Father Christmas," as Ray Lennox, walking in with Carmel Devereaux, senses that after the Rose Garden home, he is now firmly in Remain territory. He watches Carmel, dressed in Friday evening casual elegance, in a tight-ribbed purple jumper and long-checked skirt, nimbly flutter through ensembles of her university colleagues, some of whom he has met previously. He wonders if those academic types scorn him as an ex-cop now working in security, exploiting the fears of scared retirees. Looks at the sleeve of his black leather Hugo Boss jacket, the tailor of the Nazis, and also his off-the-peg choice. Glances up, unable to see Angela, whom he had chatted to extensively on the night he and Carmel met in that Hove pub. Only stopping in for a quick beer after his kickboxing training, he had struck up an easy conversation with his new girlfriend and her workmates at the bar. The mutual attraction had been evident from the off, and both Lennox and Carmel immediately understood that they would pursue it. It led slowly but inexorably from coffee to dinner to bed, all within the context of regular dates. Carmel introduces him to Gilbert Mason, a tall, fine-featured man with an exotic quiff and camp mannerisms. Soon they are talking shop and Lennox is bamboozled.
Now, resolution like all of your other books, almost all your other books, is narrated by Tam Dean Byrne. Why is Tam the voice of Irvine Welsh in the audiobook world?
Well, Tam's he's an old pal of mine's first, and he's also from Leith. I mean, his family were Tennant Street, mine's were Burlington Street, and I moved to Muirhouse when I was a kid, and well, via Pilton, and he moved to Claremaston and all that, so we've got that kind of shared history, and he just really gets it, obviously, because that's where he's from.
He's also done Filth on stage as well.
Yeah, he's a great actor, Tam. His performance in Filth is just brilliant because he has to play about 32 parts or something like that. Yeah. So he's fabulous. Yeah.
Tam Dean Byrne was also the narrator of The Blade Artist, which was recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios in Glasgow.
As he elevates her skywards, the bright sun seems to burst out from behind Eve's head, offering Jim Francis a transcendental moment that he pauses to savour before he lowers the child. The hot sand will soon punish his bare feet, he thinks, turning away from the solar flare, and he'll have to watch she doesn't burn. Eve is fine for now, though. Her bubbling machine gun giggles, urging him to continue the game. The glorious thing about working for yourself, setting your own hours, is that you can always take time off. Jim appreciates being here on the deserted beach, so early at sunrise this July morning, with his wife and two young daughters, while everybody else sleeps off their Independence Day celebration hangovers. The beach is absolutely deserted, bar some squawking seabirds.
Tam Dean Byrne reading from the book about a supposedly rehabilitated Begbie, The Blade Artist. I asked Irvine Welsh if that was still coming to TV.
Yeah, hopefully. We've got a series of meetings next week, actually, with Bobby and the director and producer and all that, you know. So, yeah, we're trying to take that forward, like, you know, trying to get the scripts kind of tonally quite right, because you want to make it a bit like Trainspotting, but not too much like Trainspotting, because he's older and all that sort of stuff. So, that's a challenge, basically. We're hoping to make progress on that, yeah.
And last time we saw you on screen was in T2, and Mikey Forrester's doing okay for himself.
Yeah, I mean, my character, Mikey Forrester, was the only upwardly mobile character in the whole thing, you know, so I was chuffed with it, yeah.
And it gets a bit meta at the end of T2 because we see Spud writing the opening lines to Trainspotting.
Oh, right, you know? Yeah. That was John's idea. I think he just wanted to wind me up and say that you're this loser like Spud, which is fair enough. Like, yeah.
Resolution, as are many books by Irvin Welsh, is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
I hate to think of people being cut off from that pleasure through no fault of their own. And it is very, very difficult to live without sight when you have been seeing. But the truth is that there is no reason for them to lose their pleasure in reading if we can just create the talking books. You know, the nightmare that faces us is how few books become talking books. And we have to change that. You know, these books will last forever now under the new technology. It's not as if one's doing it and then they get read for a summer and thrown out. This is forever. This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk. Now let's return to the RNIB Talking Books Library to find the new books, including the new one by Sally Rooney.
Intermezzo by award-winning Sally Rooney was recently donated by Faber & Faber.
Didn't seem fair in the young lad. That suit at the funeral, with the braces on his teeth, the supreme discomfort of the adolescent. On such occasions, one could almost come to regret one's own social brilliance. Gives him the excuse, or gives him, in any case, someone at whom to look pleadingly between the mandatory handshakes. God love him. Nearly 23 now, Ivan the Terrible. Difficult, actually, to believe the suit on him. Picked it up, perhaps, in some little damp-smelling second-hand shop for the local hospice. Paid in cash, rode it home on his bicycle, crumpled in a reusable plastic bag. Yes, that in fact would make sense of it, would bring into alignment the suit in its resplendent ugliness and the personality of the younger brother, 10 years younger. Not without style in his own way. Certain kind of panache in his absolute disregard for the material world. Brains and beauty, an aunt said once. About them both. Or was it Ivan Brains and Peter Beauty? Thanks, I think. He crosses Watling Street now towards the apartment that is not an apartment, the house that is not a house. 11 or is it 12 days since the funeral, back in town. Back at work, such as it is. Or back anyway to Naomi's place. And what will she be wearing when she answers the door? Slides his phone from his pocket into the palm of his hand as he reaches the front step. Cool tactility of the screen as it lights under his fingers, typing. Outside.
Aside from the fact that they are brothers, Peter and Ivan Kubek seem to have little in common. Peter is a Dublin lawyer in his 30s, successful, competent, and apparently unassailable. But in the week of their father's death, he's medicating himself to sleep and struggling to manage his relationships with two very different women. His enduring first love, Sylvia, and Naomi, a college student for whom life is one long joke. Ivan is a 22-year-old competitive chess player. He's always seen himself as socially awkward, a loner, the antithesis of his glib elder brother. Now, in the early weeks of his bereavement, Ivan meets Margaret, an older woman emerging from her own turbulent past, and their lives become rapidly and intensely intertwined.
Evening's drawing in now, and she's back at her lectures, presumably. No reply, but she sees the message, and then the predictable sequence, the so familiar and by now indirectly arousing sequence of sounds as behind the front door she comes up the old basement staircase and into the hall. Classical conditioning. How did it take so long to figure that out? Common sense. Not that. Everyday experience. The relationship of memory and feeling. The opening door. Hello, Peter, she says. A cropped cashmere tank top, thin gold necklace, and black sweatpants fitted slim at the ankle. Not elasticated, she hates that. Bare feet. May I come in? He asks. Down the staircase and into a room without seeing any of the others. Fairy lights glowing dim pinpricks against the wall. Takes his shoes off, leaves them by the door. Laptop lying splayed open on the unmade mattress. Fragrance of perfume, sweat, and cannabis, in whose blent air all our compulsions meet. Curtains hanging closed, as always. Where have you been? She asks. Ah, I'm afraid something came up. She's looking at him and then not looking, with a scoff. Off on a late summer holiday, were you? She asks. Naomi, sweetheart, he says in a friendly voice. My dad died.
Intermezzo by Sally Rooney, is read by Ina Hardwick and runs for 16 hours and 30 minutes.
Odysseus by Stephen Fry is the latest in the Mythos series, retelling the stories of ancient Greece. It was donated by Penguin Random House.
It is common to portray us mortals as the children of the gods. But in reality, it is the gods who are children. Like children, the gods have no patience. Like children, they erupt into tantrums when their desires are thwarted. And when they discover that those desires are not what they wanted after all, they stamp their feet and scream in fury. No rage is wilder and more unendurable for mortals or immortals than that which is self-directed. Watching the smoke rise from the ruined city of Troy, and hearing the last weepings of the slaughtered and their survivors, Athena found herself haunted by a feeling of dread. Everything she had worked for had come to pass. The impertinent Paris, who had presumed to judge her beauty inferior to the cheap appeal of Aphrodite, had paid for his insolence, dying in agony outside the walls of his adopted city. Helen, the prize Aphrodite had helped Paris steal, would soon be on her way back to Sparta in the company of her lawful husband, King Menelaus. A great wrong had been righted. The victory of the Achaean forces over the defending Trojans was absolute. As great golden Troy burned into ruin and rubble, Athena felt no surge of triumph.
Wily Odysseus, king of Ithaca, has won Troy for the Greeks after a decade of brutal, bloody warfare. But now this warrior remembers he is a husband and father, and his gaze turns longingly towards home. Setting sail with a small fleet, Odysseus dreams of soon lying in the arms of his beloved wife, Penelope, and of teaching his son, Telemachus, the ways of a warrior. However, the gods laugh at the foolish hopes of mortals, and angered by this upstart, Poseidon, god of the ocean realms, curses our hero to wander the seas for 10 long years. Encountering one-eyed giants, six-headed monsters, terrible storms, titanic whirlpools, hypnotic sirens, seductive witches and jealous goddesses, Odysseus is tempted and tormented beyond any man's endurance. Yet he is no mere mortal, and the lure of his wife and son draws him, step by step, stroke by stroke, ever closer to home and his ultimate destiny.
What she felt, she could not call it shame, surely no Olympian could feel shame, was a blend of horror and disappointment that was new to her. Was it possible that mortals were beginning to infect the gods with the perverse self-indulgence of inner feelings? It was for the gods to inspire humankind into imitations of divinity, not for humans to shrink the gods into flawed images of themselves. With the fall of Troy, something else had fallen, but Athena was not able to say quite what it was. She had a sense that nothing in the mortal or the immortal realms could ever be the same again.
Odyssey, the story of Odysseus by Stephen Fry, is read by the author and runs for 10 hours and 37 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
RNIB Library has all the latest reading titles in a format that suits your needs. You choose the books, you choose the format, we deliver to your door. Follow us on Twitter at RNIB Library or find us on Facebook.
Finally on today's show, a quick chat with and some book recommendations from Elizabeth Oldfield, who was at the Wigtown Book Festival with her book Fully Alive. It's part memoir, part manifesto for how we might live deeper, wiser lives and becoming the kind of people we think the world might need. Elizabeth is also the host of the podcast Sacred, so it was natural that she read the audiobook of Fully Alive herself.
A few years ago, I was driving along a dual carriageway with my husband and kids. It was hot and the air was stale, my passenger seat footwell strewn with tepid water bottles and keep cups and empty Pombear packets. We'd long outgrown our tiny, bashed-up city car, but couldn't stretch to a bigger one. And so packing involved a complex Jenga game of maximising space while avoiding a child being crushed by a suitcase. My daughter was in the back, singing along to When I Grow Up, a song from the musical Matilda. In her reedy, unself-conscious voice, she belted out Tim Minchin's deceptively simple lyrics, which predict a future in which the children singing will be grown up enough to know how to answer hard questions, strong enough to carry heavy things, and brave enough to fight the monsters underneath the bed. The chorus, beloved by kids everywhere, is all about eating sweets and staying up late to watch endless TV. But it was these verses and their childlike melody that landed that day like a punch in the heart. The irreconcilably bittersweet nature of adulthood was suddenly too much. I am purportedly a grown-up, but don't know the answers. I feel bone-weary from carrying around heavy things. I hate that the monsters exist, and that they often win, and that some of them live in me. I broke down and started sobbing, my heave so abrupt that my husband pulled the car over in concern. I didn't want my daughter to have to grow up into this world. I wanted her to find, as the song promises, that being a grown-up really is about doing what you want in a cartoon world of freedom. Not this discombobulating cocktail of beauty and heartbreak, despair and delight, the longing for justice and our own utter and bewildering failure to enact it. I don't think this conviction that the world should be different, that we should be different, is unique to those who procreate. Honestly, I think the grief is also for myself, for the child I used to be, the innocence I have lost. I would like to put the apple back on the tree, please, because the knowledge of good and evil is just too damn painful.
My book is called Fully Alive, Tending to the Soul in Turbulent Times, and it's personal essays, reflections, loosely structured around the seven deadly sins, really asking the question, how do we become the kind of person the world needs? Some spirituality, some philosophy, some memoir.
I don't think I am the only one who feels this. We joke about adulting, the drudgery of paying bills and sorting out a pension. But it can't be just me who hears the seriousness thrum underneath. What kind of person am I becoming with all this living? What kind of person do I want to be becoming? What part am I playing in the tragicomedy we all find ourselves in? Growing up must, surely, be about more than ticking or failing to tick achievements off an arbitrary list. It must be about something deeper. Yet the stories that used to orient and guide us, handed down through generations of our ancestors, seem to have got lost in transit.
So how can we sort of lead a better life and not focus on the minutiae of everyday life, you know, the trivialities of life?
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? Remembering to pay attention to the things that are important. One of the sins I talk about is called acedia, which is this Latin word, often gets translated sloth. It actually means something different from that. Spiritual apathy and distraction is the closest to that. And it's endemic, right? We all spend too much time on our phones. We spend too much time paying attention to stuff that passes away, that doesn't last, and not these big things like, who are we becoming? How well do we love? Are we brave? Are we kind? Are we free? The kind of things you want people to say at your funeral. And so I think there are rituals and practices and postures from our religious traditions which can really help us, whether you are someone who would call themselves religious or not.
Today's plural, secular, Western societies have gifted us many things, but reliable sources of communal meaning isn't one of them. So many people I speak to crave places to belong and ways to settle their soul. Technology has freed us from drudgery and offers endless ways to increase our comfort and convenience. Product after product promises to boost our status and performance, optimize and maximize up and to the right. In lots of ways, we've never had it better. But still, there is a malaise, a sense of impending threat, which many of us feel in our least defended moments and don't know how to speak about. The news scrolls unendingly with stories of war, disease, deepening division, the rise of authoritarian governments, and the unimaginable but rapidly approaching prospect of climate collapse. Accelerating advances in AI may turn the world upside down in ways no one can predict. Against this ominous global mood music, we have unlimited choices in framing our identity, but this freedom can sometimes induce vertigo rather than exhilaration. Many of us feel isolated and anxious, or too distracted and overworked to feel much at all.
Now, you read the audiobook. How was that?
It was delightful. I really enjoyed it. I host a podcast, so I used to work in BBC Radio. Audio is very much my favourite world.
Tell us about your podcast.
It's called The Sacred, and I speak to people from a very wide range of different tribes, metaphysical, professional, political perspectives about their deep values. I ask them, what is sacred to them? How are they trying to live a good life, and how would they define that?
In the 1930s, a man called Thomas Merton was part of a group of irreverent and hard-drinking proto-beatniks who were similarly dismayed at the state of the world. University-educated as they were, the prospects that mainstream society offered look less and less appealing. The world is crazy. War threatens. One has lost a sense of identity. People are dropping out. The rest of us are just lost. The cry of Merton and his friends then echoes now. I am not only physically tired, just filled with a deep, vague, undefined sense of spiritual distress. I don't want to live in spiritual distress. I want to be fully alive.
Fully Alive by Elizabeth Oldfield is available commercially now. I also asked Elizabeth for some book recommendations for Books of My Life.
So is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with books and reading?
Well, I think probably like 98% of your listeners, the Stephen Fry Harry Potter audiobooks were a big part of my introduction to the beauty of the genre. But in terms of general children books that really formed me, there's one called The Mousehole Cat, which is a beautiful picture book written about the town of Mousehole in Cornwall. And it's one of those gorgeous epic tales about love and self-sacrifice and connection with nature. And what does it mean to be brave? And it's really stayed with me.
The next morning, they set out very early before the others were waking. Before they went, Tom stoked up the old range and damped it down so that it would burn steadily until they returned. Then he hung a lamp in the window so that it would shine out across the harbour and light their way. As they reached the quayside, Mauser looked back through the wind and rain and thought how warm and welcoming the window looked. Soon their little boat was crossing the harbour towards the Mousehole Gap, and the voice of the great storm cat rose all around them like a giant caterwauling. As she listened to his wailing, Mauser felt a sudden, strange sadness for him. How lonely he must be, she thought, endlessly hunting the men mice in the deeps of darkness and never returning to the rosy glow of a red-hot range. And her kind heart was moved to comfort him.
Bernard Cribbins reading from The Mousehole Cat, which came out on CD a number of years ago. You can still find it in places like eBay, or alternatively, the whole thing is available on YouTube. The Stephen Fry read Harry Potter books are all available from RNIB Talking Books. Is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Many. I love Golden Age detective stories, particularly Dorothy L. Sayers. I like Georgian romances. I like anything by Marilyn Robinson. I reread Middlemarch regularly. But yes, detective stories and romances are the rainy day ones for comfort and coziness.
Oh, Dan,
said Lord Peter Wimsey at Piccadilly Circus.
Hi, driver.
The taxi man, irritated at receiving this appeal while negotiating the intricacies of turning into Lower Regent Street across the route of a 19 bus, a 38B and a bicycle, bent an unwilling ear.
I've left the catalogue behind, said Lord Peter, deprecatingly. Uncommonly careless of me. Do you mind putting me back to where we came from?
To the Savile Club, sir?
No. 110A Piccadilly, just beyond, thank you.
Thought you was in a hurry, said the man, overcome with a sense of injury.
I'm afraid it's an awkward place to turn in,
said Lord Peter, answering the thought rather than the words. His long, amiable face looked as if it had generated spontaneously from his top hat, as white maggots breed from Gorgonzola. The taxi, under the severe eye of a policeman, revolved by slow jerks with a noise like the grinding of teeth. The block of new, perfect and expensive flats in which Lord Peter dwelt upon the second floor stood directly opposite the Green Park, in a spot for many years occupied by the skeleton of a frustrate commercial enterprise. As Lord Peter let himself in, he heard his man's voice in the library, uplifted in that throttle stridency peculiar to well-trained persons using the telephone.
I believe that's his lordship just coming in again. If your grace would kindly hold the line a moment.
What is it, Bunter?
Her Grace just called up from Denver, my lord. I was just saying your lordship had gone to the sale when I heard your lordship's latchkey.
Thanks, said Lord Peter. And you might find me my catalogue, would you? I think I must have left it in my bedroom, or on the desk.
He sat down to the telephone with an air of leisurely courtesy, as though it were an acquaintance dropped in for a chat.
Hello, Mother. That you?
Roger D. Watson reading Whose Body? Lord Peter Wimsey, Book 1 by Dorothy L. Sayers. Available in the RNIB Library.
And is there something you've read recently? It doesn't have to be contemporary, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
Faith, Hope and Carnage by Nick Cave and Sean O'Hagan. It's one of the best books I've read in the last 5 years. It's a conversation between two old friends who believe very different things, but it is honest and raw and beautiful.
So, Nick, I'm surprised you agreed to do this, given that you haven't done any interviews for a long time.
Well, who wants to do an interview? Interviews in general suck. Really. They eat you up. I hate them. The whole premise is so demeaning. You have a new album coming out, or a new film to promote, or a book to sell. After a while, you just get worn away by your own story. I guess at some point I just realized that doing that kind of interview was of no real benefit to me. It only ever took something away. I always had to recover a bit afterwards. It was like I had to go looking for myself again. So 5 years or so ago, I just gave them up.
So given that, how do you feel about this undertaking?
Well, I don't know. I do like having a conversation. I like to talk, to engage with people. And we've always had our big, sprawling conversations. So when you suggested, I was kind of intrigued to see where it would go. So let's see, shall we?
So when I spoke to you back in March 2020, your world tour had just been cancelled because of the pandemic. I have to say you sounded remarkably philosophical about it.
Well, it was a strange moment, that's for sure. When COVID hit and my manager Brian told me that we weren't going on tour, I felt a kind of emptying out, like the whole world had dropped out from under me. We'd all put an enormous amount of thought and effort into how we were going to present Ghosteen live, and we'd been rehearsing with 10 backing singers and created a whole visual structure for the show that felt completely unique and very exciting. A whole lot of work, mental energy and expense. So when I heard it definitely wasn't going to happen, I was initially horrified. It struck at the very core of my being because I was this thing that toured. It's what I was. Now, I say this with great caution because I know how disappointed the fans were, but to be honest, that feeling of existential collapse, well, it lasted about half an hour. Then I remember standing in my manager's office and thinking somewhat guiltily, I'm not going on tour. And perhaps for an entire year. Suddenly there was this extraordinary sense of relief, a sort of wave washing through me like a kind of euphoria. But also something more than that, a crazy energy.
A sense of potential, maybe?
Yeah, but true potential. Potential is powerlessness, ironically. Not the potential to do something, but the potential not to do something.
Faith, Hope and Carnage by Nick Cave and Sean O'Hagan is available commercially as read by the authors. And thanks once again to Elizabeth Oldfield. That's all we've got time for on today's show. Thanks to everyone at the Wigtown Book Festival. You can find me on X at @talking_books. And you can find almost 400 episodes of Read On by searching for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. We'll be back next week.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.